Today I'll be going to our conference at the university. It's called Leith Conference, or Constance on the topic of existence. It's something that we do on a yearly basis and has replaced our summer conference at the farm, because obviously we get more people here in Budapest, and it's more easily accessible to people even from around the country. And the venue is a large auditorium at the university. We'll see if it matches last year's venue. Was a smaller auditorium, which was completely jam-packed. And there'll be different presentations. Let me just read them to you. First one will be from a psychologist, Gadi Tamash, and he'll talk about the role of the family in the development of relationships. Oh, by the way, the title of this conference is Outline and Development of Relationships. And then following him, I'm giving a presentation under the title of Vaishnava Theologian on the transcendental nature of relationships. And then there'll be another psychiatrist, the chances for real friendship and love. Then we have our lunch break, and in the afternoon there'll be a roundtable discussion in which different theologians will be present, from an evangelical theologian, a rabbi, and Gaur Krishna will be representing us. And that topic is, can love be learned and taught? And following that, Amritananda will be giving a presentation on friendship and the culture of friendship and love as described in the Mahabharata. And the last one, which goes from 4 to 5, is a debate between Gaur Krishna and another psychologist on how we can improve relationships between people. I'll just give you a little overview of what my presentation is going to be, referring to my notes, and most likely the whole thing will be videoed. So we'll try and put it on a later podcast. Anyway, it starts off by raising the question, what is a relationship? And we give the answer that the common basis of interaction amongst two or more people is our definition of relationship, which were based upon the teachings of the Vedas, beginning with the Bhagavad Gita, and defined in more detail in other Vedic books like Bharat Muni's Nata Shastra, and then following in the modern day by Rupa Goswami and Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu and other texts. What do we mean when we talk about common basis? We're talking about a commodity exchange that all parties agree on. And without having such a common basis, then from our perspective, there's no way to really relate, which means that there's no real relationship, or if you want to call it a relationship, then call it a dysfunctional one. The word exchange implies two different concepts. One is that there's both a subject and an object in a relationship, and the other one is that the roles of the subject and the object alternate, which I'll get to a little later. However, Let us define both of these concepts, and we'll start with what is object and what is subject. Object is a person to whom actions or feeling is directed, and subject is the person who acts or feels. The second concept of alternating roles means that in a relationship there are times when a person is the object, and then at other times when he's the subject, and vice versa, the subject becomes the object. Let's also clarify what it is that this commodity of exchange is in a relationship. And the answer to that will be is that it's what we call the word bhava, or emotion. It's the primary commodity, and the consequence of that primary commodity is action. Sometimes people say that the commodity of change is a relationship is action itself. But action is inaugurated by a feeling, or some people may want to call it a thought. And until you have that feeling or thought, whether you're conscious of it or not, there's no real question of acting. Acting is first based upon an initial impetus. And emotion or bhava is of eight kinds. I've simplified the presentation in Nectar of Devotion. The primary one is love, and there are seven secondary ones, including amazement, humor, and chivalry. These secondary ones are not independent emotions, but rather they're dependent on the original or primary one, which is love. And they only enhance or enrich that primary emotion. The example one can conceive of is that in the large waves of an ocean, there are ripples on top of those waves. The ripples have no independent existence from the waves. They're dependent upon it. Anyway, these seven secondary ones, we're not going to have much time to delve into, but we'll go through a little analysis of what the primary loving emotions are. And we list them from neutral, servile, friendly, parental, and conjugal. So in a loving relationship, when we get back to the concept of subject and object, the person who loves is the subject of love, and the person who is being loved is the object of love. So if, say, I am the husband, and I am relating to my wife, I am exhibiting love to her, say, in the form of speech, then I am the subject of love in terms of when I'm communicating to her my feelings of affection, and she becomes the object of that love. When seen in the perspective of speaking, if we want to see love in the perspective of hearing, then the roles are different. Then it is because the wife is hearing, and therefore, from the hearing point of view, the husband who's speaking, he becomes the object of hearing, and the wife becomes the subject, because she's the one who's active in the process. And then, of course, the wife then reciprocates. She becomes the speaker, and then from the point of view of speaking, then the roles of subject and object once again change. But that's not all. There are another two further aspects of love. One is the character of the love of the five types of emotion, and the other one is the quality of the love. And the character of the love defines the ingredients which make up these five different types of primary affection. In neutrality, the primary character of love is passive. It's inspired by awe, but there's no direct contact. It's something that takes place from a distance. Whereas in servitude, there's direct service to the person. That means that there's some connection. And, of course, servitude also includes the quality of neutrality, because the respect or inspiration caused by a greater personality or another personality still remains. Therefore, as the types of love progress, they include the previous or the characteristics of the previous types of love. So when we come to friendship, where there's a type of confident intimacy in friendship, but that also includes service, there's some kind of active relationship going on, and still there is a respect, which means that the quality of neutrality is there. The ultimate relationship is the conjugal, ultimate meaning that it has the most aspects of love present. In other words, it has complete surrender or the offering of one's body to the beloved, and simultaneously there's a sense of maintenance, which is there in the parental, as well as confident intimacy, which is there in friendship. There's the sense of service, that one is actually performing some direct activity, and there's also respect. And we see that in the absence of any of these, even the conjugal relationship is not complete. Anyway, much could be said about this, but time is short, and I'm going to do puja and head off in 40 minutes. So another aspect of love is its quality, which may be either pure or impure. One may question, well, what constitutes the difference between pure and impure love? And the answer there is the knowledge of who is the lover, the subject, and who is the beloved, or the object. By what type of knowledge do you approach these two persons, or do they approach each other? So wrong knowledge is when the subject and object identify each other with their bodies and their minds, and that results in impure and temporary love. This is the type of love that comes as a result of knowledge that we acquire nowadays in our modern educational institutions. Our modern consumer society promotes this. In fact, it's the basis of the world in which we live in. It is, in principle, promoting this type of identity, because it's this type of identity which feeds the basis of our modern social philosophy. Now, right knowledge is to identify, and when the subject and object identify themselves as soul and servants of God, and that leads to pure and eternal knowledge, which is something that's given in the revealed scriptures and is taught by non-sectarian and transcendental religions. Here, of course, a dissertation is going to follow in identifying ourselves as spirit, soul, as opposed to body, by enumerating a little on Dehi Nosmin Jata Dehi, which Vaishnavas are all clear with. And the consequence of this is that a pure relationship will only result from knowledge of spiritual identity. An impure relationship results from ignorance of that. Which means that all types of knowledge, whether it is in the medical field or scientific field, what have you, when it excludes this knowledge of the soul, it remains, for all of the benefits that one may reap from it, incomplete, because it doesn't identify, address the fundamental identity of our correct spiritual identity. The question rises, can love be had from some outside source? And the answer is no. Knowledge of identity, when we have proper knowledge of our identity, it awakens pure love within us. And when we're covered by ignorance, which, as I just mentioned, knowledge that excludes our identity, then everything becomes impure. People may argue that relationships based on the body can work, and for that we're bringing some statistics in. For instance, in terms of love or marriage, 55% of marriages end in divorce in Hungary. In terms of parental affection, almost 50% of children who are conceived are later aborted. And further statistics which emphasize how employees cheat their employers, etc., etc. Summarizing that means that the exchange of love between one temporary limited body and another temporary limited body, or at least people who conceive of them as such, ends in temporary and limited love. However, the exchange of love between individuals who conceive of themselves as eternal spirit soul and another eternal spirit soul last in a lasting, powerful relationship. Of course, there's a hidden ingredient, there's a secret for this pure relationship to function, and that is the inclusion of God within the relationship. People are eager to exclude God from relationship amongst men, but that's not possible, because God is within everything, and He's also everywhere. So, how does a complete relationship with God involved work? If we as persons become the subject, making God the supreme master in as the and the common object of all of our love in a mood of servitude, then on this fundamental basis, on this foundation, then any of the five or all of the five relationships in which we exchange become natural, pure, long-lasting, and rewarding. And this is the type of knowledge that is found in any religion. It isn't that one has to become a Hindu in order to have this type of vision. It requires that religions have a clear concept of, number one, that we're the soul and not this body. Number two, that the body is a dress for the soul. Number three, that God is a supreme person. And number four, that as He is the master, we are His servants. So this is a brief analysis of relationships, which is based on Bhagavad Gita, and I'm offering this to these assembled guests with the idea of overcoming sectarian, gender, racial, ethnic, and other prejudices in the effort for us to love each other and learn to establish real relationships in our lives. Unfortunately, our modern society tries very artificially in a reactive mode to support relationships based on their misconceived idea of bodily identification. But because that identification is essentially flawed, it never works. So it has to include the concept of soul and God. And when it does, then that becomes a proactive relationship.